session number 9253, room 19.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, Reel 19. You were telling me a story concerning a listening post in No Man's Land. I wonder if you could continue.
I said to the officer, "How do you know the listening post is all right? Who is it anyway?" He said, "It's Corporal Fotheringham." He said, "He knows you." I said, "I know him." I said, "At home," because we were all territorial soldiers, you know. I said, "At home, his son is in my scout troop as a patrol leader, so I know Corporal Fotheringham." I said, "He's a queer one." And I said, "He's out on listening post." And I said, "He has this wire from here to where he is." He says, the officer says, "Yes, it's a good idea, isn't it?" I said, "It's a damn bad idea." I says, "What about if a German patrol comes along and feels a wire that moves?" Because I says, "Your signals, you must use tugs for signals." He says, "Yes, we do." He says, "Do you want to know the signal?" I says, "I don't want to know signals at all." I says, "Come on," to the officer. "Come on. We'll bring this listening post, which isn't a listening post." I said, "He's advertising himself to the Germans, your listening post. Advertising himself. Fancy a German patrol coming along and he feels or sees some wire moving." I said, "He must know somebody's at the end of that wire." And I said, "He'll find your listening post." I said, "It's a damn bad idea and you had no right to allow him to do so." He said, "Don't you talk to me like that." I says, "I'll talk worse than that to me, to you." I says, "It's my job for everything that happens out in No Man's Land. And that's what comes in within my jurisdiction. Come along." So we climbed out the trench and followed the wire. And it was only a few yards. Only a few yards. The officer got a... He got a shock as well. Told me that this listening post was out in front of his own barbed wire. And it weren't. They were between his barbed wire and the trench. Jimmy Fotheringham, Corporal Fotheringham, and his listening post had just climbed it over the parapet and he just lay there quite comfy, pulling wires, signaling him back to say things was all right. And that was a listening post that wasn't.
Would he get into trouble about that?
I don't know. I was finished as far as I was concerned. That matter was finished. That was left between the officer and... the officer was in the wrong as well. I don't suppose there was anything made of it. But he would be aware of following him in future.
Did your responsibilities cover barbed wire and its establishment and upkeep?
Oh, yes, rather. Well, no. No, just my duties. Everything that happened in No Man's Land was part of my job. But building up barbed wire wasn't my job. I mean, that was the company commander who was responsible for his own trenches and his own barbed wire. You take, for instance, in the early part of 1915, the early part of 1915 was a much different war to 1917. I mean, you take, for instance, barbed wire, the erection of barbed wire in front of your own trench. In the early part of 1915, we were supplied with wooden posts, pointed head, and a big wooden hammer. The wooden posts had to be driven into the ground with a wooden hammer, big wooden heavy hammer. Fellas used to wrap sandbags around the head of the hammer to deaden the sound of any the blow was struck against the post to drive it into the ground. The sound of that hammer, even with the sandbags wrapped around, could stretch out in the quiet night of trench warfare, and you could perhaps hear a sniper bullet come whigging across, or a machine gun, so that you only got a couple of blows or so to drive it in, and then you had to duck down. And then when the machine gun had passed by, the bullets had passed by, you had another few strokes. And then the barbed wire in those days was single-strand barbed wire wrapped on a pole carried by two men, very awkward in no man's land in the dark. And you'd stretch your wire between one post and another, back and forward, to make a real barbed wire entanglement. That was in the early days of 1915. As the war progressed, before the summer was over in 1915, that wooden post was abolished, and we had a steel bar, twisted bar, with a loop at one end, and at the other end it was sharpened. And all you needed to do, instead of using a wooden post, you put a piece of stick in the loop at the top of this 3-foot steel bar and turn it down into the ground, and made a very effective post. Also, the single strand of barbed wire had been disregarded, and barbed wire was there then, about the end of the summer of 1915, though in coils, the barbed wire, coil of wire with barbed wire attached, and had a width of you could stand the length of barbed wire would stretch about 8 yards, and could be compressed into a foot or so. That could be one end could be attached to the steel bar and then stretch another 7 or 8 yards to the next bar, which made the erection of barbed wire entanglements a much easier job than driving in posts and using a single strand. And that's how barbed wire was erected. Well, now, that was all right for one length of barbed wire. But to get through that barbed wire, because it was no use having gaps. At first, there was gaps laid. There was gaps between the barbed wire, between one post and another. And then a second line of barbed wire entanglements would be erected a few yards beyond. But where the entrance, to get through the barbed wire, they never had to be in line with each other, or the Germans could pick them out, as we could pick theirs out. So that the original opening in the barbed wire on the first line was always somewhere different in the second line. And if you had a third line of barbed wire, that would be in a different part altogether. Then our battalion, used another method to get through the barbed wire. One could creep along the barbed wire until you came to where, if we had erected that barbed wire, we left an opening at the bottom on the ground in the barbed wire, tied the barbed wire back on its coils, and you could creep through. But in the dark, you didn't know where, you couldn't find that. You had no indication where the hole was through the barbed wire along the ground. So what we did was we collected empty jam tins, empty meat tins, and we always piled them at the entrance to one of these bury holes through the barbed wire. You could creep along the edge of the barbed wire until you come to a heap of empty tins, and you knew then you could creep through the barbed wire. And then when you were through, you had to search for the next heap of tins to get through the second line and so on into the third. I never came to trenches that had more than three. Mostly they had two lines of barbed wire, and in some cases they had three lines.
How thick would each line of barbed wire be?
The width of it. Well, it's about 2 foot six. You know, the coil was about 2 foot six wide.
So there would just be one coil, it wouldn't be multi-layered?
No, oh no. And then you, to get over that, you know, it's stretched tight, you know. Well, it's the most difficult job to get over that barbed wire if you were climbing over the top, because the barbs would hinder you in going over, because a soldier's uniform is made of very serviceable cloth, khaki cloth, very strong khaki cloth. It might grip the cloth, but it took a lot to tear the khaki cloth, the soldier's uniform. Speaking of uniform, when I joined the Territorial Army in 1911, I did 3 years training in England before war was declared on August the 4th, 1914. I still had that same uniform. We trained in England for some months, and then we went overseas in April 1915, still with the uniform that I had when I joined in 1911. And during the whole of my period in 1915 and 1916, that was the only uniform I ever had, a very serviceable uniform. Might I describe the uniform? A soldier's uniform at that time, big, strong, heavy leather boots, not shoes, boots. In England, they had to be polished when on parade. But when overseas, you were supplied with a tin of grease, and they had to be greased. They were tied with strong leather laces. Khaki trousers with braces, all army issue. Two shirts, a body shirt, and another shirt, which the khaki shirt to cover. Your tunic was a real tunic, stretched from the neck right nearly down to the knee. Two breast pockets with a flap over buttoned, two side pockets, very wide, could hold your pipe and matches and all your personal belongings on the side pockets. Your hat. When we first went out to, when we were in training in England, and when we first went out overseas, we had a cloth cap with a peak in front. Very serviceable. And it wasn't until late 1915 that hat was replaced by the steel helmet. In our battalion, we never had a steel helmet till the late summer of 1915. And that completed your putties. Of course, we wore putties, which a pair of putties, long khaki cloth about 3 inches wide, strong, one for each leg, starting at the boot and wrapping it around your leg up to the knee. And then it had the tip at the top, which you tucked in underneath and held it. Always loosening the trousers a little, so that you could bend your nay in your trousers without holding, being held down by your putties. That was your uniform. We were supplied with the Lee Enfield rifle. The Lee Enfield rifle, you could put one in the breech, and then you had a machine. You had a machine, with five bullets in it. And it was very simple, and you fired your bullet out of your rifle to slip the magazine that was contained in five bullets into the side of the Lee Enfield rifle, and there you had six bullets always ready for action. Spare bullets were carried in special slings. A sling with pockets in it to contain the magazine of five bullets, so that you could have a supply of about 30 or 36 rifle bullets, 35 rifle bullets at any one time.
What rate of fire could you achieve with the Lee Enfield?
What?
How many shots could you fire in a minute?
Oh, I have no idea. We did a lot of shooting in England in preparation for going overseas. We used to go to shooting ranges ever so often during the year, you know, territorial training. And I was considered as a good shot. Not an expert shot, but a good shot. And you had to learn, of course, because on your elevation on your rifle, you had a special attachment on the top of your rifle, which you lift up, and over 200 yards, you had to use the elevation so as to get a correct spot to aim at.
Right, getting back now to No Man's Land and what you used to do there, could you tell me about the incident where you were awarded the MM, Military Medal?
That's a long story. Well, as usual, I was out in No Man's Land, and one of the companies had a covering party out in front of their own barbed wire, three lines of barbed wire, for a working party which was on their on the barbed wire, repairing the barbed wire and the frontline trench. And as I approached them, one of their covering party received a sniper bullet from the Germans right through the body, and it began to make a lot of noise. Private Somerville, I found out, was his name later. Arriving on the spot, I said to the corporal in charge, I says, send your men back, your covering party, because with this noise, the Germans are going to know that something happened. So the corporal sent his men back to the trenches, his covering party. The corporal and I were left with this wounded man out in front in No Man's Land in front of three lines of barbed wire. We started off. We never bothered to look for where you could creep through the outer line of barbed wire. We got a hold of Private Somerville, and we flung him on top of the barbed wire, and we climbed over afterwards. Some of us shouting all the time, me clouting him to keep him quiet. Didn't keep him quiet. The Germans knew everything we were doing. Luckily, they only used, as far as I can remember, a couple of machine guns, sweeping back and forward on the length of the trench, and then back again, and so on. However, we got over the third line, the outside line of barbed wire, with the wounded man, the corporal and I. And then an officer from the trench, Major Walsh, came out. The fellows of the Covenant Party had arrived back into the... This all took time. And the fellows had reported that Sergeant Dorgan was out there with a man that was wounded. So Major Walsh says to the corporal, "You go back, and the sergeant and I will bring the wounded man in." We were then in between the second line of barbed wire and the third. So we bent down, the two of us, the major and I, to pick up Private Somerville. And a bullet came and hit Walsh in the shoulder. It must have just passed my face, because when you're picking up a man, the three heads were close together. However, it was Walsh who got hit right in the shoulder. He dropped the wounded man and left me. And away he went back. I don't know how he went, but he went back and left me with this fella, Somerville, to the trench. There I was, out in no man's land, in between our own second and third line of barbed wire, with a wounded man. So I got a hold of him, pulled him up, shoved him on top of the barbed wire, climbed up over him, rolled him off the barbed wire, and got him then between our first line of barbed wire and second. The German machine guns were then firing and hitting, and the coot hit exact top of our front line trench, which prevented anybody else coming out, or deterred them from coming out to help me, because they all knew then, the fellas in the trenches, it was only me to bring this wounded man in. But nobody could come out to help me. So, and the wounded man shouting, the bullet through his body. I got him onto the first line of barbed wire and tumbled him over. All this has taken time. My worry at that time, if I had any worry, was that daylight would catch me out in no man's land. Got him over the first line of barbed wire. And then I had about 8 or 9 yards to haul Private Somerville to our trench, punt line trench. Now, when you dig a trench, you throw the soil out, you throw it either side of the, on the surface. And then as the days go, as you occupy the trench, you place full sandbags on top, and so that when you're in a trench, apart from the actual depth from the surface, it's the trench is deepened through these additional sandbags, full sandbags, to lift them up. So I'm lying out in no man's land, and there, to me, was our front line trench, about 4 or 5 feet. And I had to get that wounded man up that trench to get him up the front of the trench and drop him into the trench. I lay him down. He couldn't do anything. No use being sorry for him. I had a job to do. Lay him down, and I lay down alongside of him and with my feet. I had a long rest. And the fellas in the trench were shouting encouragement. But nobody could come out to help me. So eventually, against Private Somerville, laid out at the bottom of this heap of soil and sandbags, which was the whole parapet of the trench. And with my feet, listening and waiting for the German machine guns, the two, it was only two, we were lucky they only used the two. And sometimes they were going the full length of the trench, and sometimes they were only going a few yards and swinging back. So I had to take a chance when I thought there was no machine gun bullets striking the top of the trench. You could hear them and feel them hitting the top of the trench. And with my feet, I rolled Private Somerville. He couldn't help me at all, poor fella. Up the side of the front of the parapet, and then soldiers inside the trench picked him up. Stretcher bearers, of course, would be there, I expect, I don't know. And then I lay. I must have lain 10, 15 minutes, exhausted. Then I waited my opportunity to get up this front of the parapet into the trench. When I got into the trench, found nobody there. Found nobody there. Not even a sentry group. I sat and I lay on that fire step. And that was the end of it as far as I was concerned.
Where had they all gone?
Well, you see, Major Welsh came back wounded. And stretcher bearers would attend to him and take him away. And then the other fellas drifted. It's taken a long time for me to come, you know, to do this little journey. But it was that's what happened. There was nobody there.
Why did you not look for the gaps in the wire? Couldn't you have got him through the gaps?
Well, there's just room for a man to creep through. You think of barbed wire, a height of about 3 foot, 3 or 3 foot 6, circular width and height, and a gap. A gap was just made so you could creep through. You couldn't pull a man in behind you, or even you couldn't shove a man in behind you, in front of you. The only way to get a wounded man was to fling him over the top, like what I did.
Was this a common problem then in No Man's Land, if anyone got wounded?
Yes. Oh yes, oh yes. Oh yes, he was badly on. I mean, all the pulling and shoving and all that didn't help anybody with a bullet through him, you know. No.
Did you ever find out what happened to Somerville?
No, you never. That was one of the things. A soldier never knows what happens after it leaves him. You know, it's passed away from me, you see. I never knew nothing about Walsh after that. I didn't know the man. I just knew we had an officer called Walsh, but I never had much contact with him. Yes.